I'm afraid Tuesday I forgot to turn on the recorder, so if any of you are reviewing in 2 months, look for that lecture. It's not going to be there. The whiteboard will be there, but not the lecture. Let's start with the stuff I ended with last time, which is the application of our thoughts about risk allocation to some legal rules. For example, I rent a house, it burns down. Should the rules be such that the cost ends up on me or on the owner? What's the argument for putting the cost on me? Because I'm the person who has most control over the kind of things that make houses burn down. I'm living there, right? I'm the one who does or doesn't pile trash somewhere next to the fireplace, does or doesn't smoke in bed, and so forth. What's the argument for having the owner bear the cost? And does it depend on various features of the owner?
Is certain types of causes of fire or probably must be due to whatever?
It might be partly a matter of he didn't put a sprinkler system in, or any other reasons why you might want the owner to bear it? Other than the fact that you're you and he's him. What? I'm not sure I understand you. It's going to be inconvenient for anybody to have to pay for a house burning down.
Have the owner to repair it.
The question is, who should bear the cost? The house burns down, they've got to replace it or got to pay a whole lot of money to fix it or whatever. Should that cost be borne by the tenant or the owner?
Tenant's only invested, it's limited amount of time in the property, whereas the owner presumably has majority invested, so they have to replace 10 times their investment into the property because the grass fire burned the house down.
So what's wrong with that? That is, for either of them, $100,000 has been lost. Why should you? We've got one reason to assign the loss to the tenant, namely that
the tenant has nothing after he rebuilds the house. Right, he has the right to continue to lease the property. That's all that he has. Whereas the owner has the property.
Yeah, but the owner had the property before he started. So rebuilding the house only brings him back to where he was before. Tenant has whatever other assets he had. I mean, if your house burns down, should we say I should pay for it? Because after all, I have a house already, so I can, after I pay for rebuilding your house, I still have a house. It doesn't sound like much of an argument. What's usually in tension with moral hazard arguments in insurance issues? What's the usual trade-off? Moral hazard versus what? Why do you ever buy insurance? Not ever. Why do you ever buy insurance where the insurer is not controlling the risk? Why do you ever buy fire insurance on the house you live in when you know that the insurance company is not going to do any inspecting or anything else? What? Yeah, risk aversion, that's right. So you might have a case, depending on the landlord and tenant, if the landlord is somebody who owns a bunch of houses that he rents out or a bunch of other kind of property he rents out, he might be in a better position to spread risk than the individual tenant. So that would be a possible reason, depending on the circumstances, but of course it could be the other way around. It could be that the landlord is a retired person, that this house is his entire source of income, whereas the tenant is a wealthy physician or something who can afford to. You don't know. How about I buy land from John, and being a less than perfectly honest person, the gold bars I pay him with are actually lead, with a thin plating of gold to fool him. And I then I then sell the land to Bill and skip town. Does John buy the land on the grounds that I never really paid for it, or does Bill own the land on the ground that he's got this valid title from me and I had a title from John? What should the legal rule be there? Or what is it, if any of you know? I don't. But I think I once did. Anybody? I buy land from you fraudulently. I then sell the land for him, to him. I pocket the money and leave town. When the fraud is discovered, which of the two of you owns the land? Yep.
I think the innocent buyer, the idea of a bona fide purchaser without notice, it would depend on the circumstances of the sale. If the party who claims innocence had reason to know of the fraud, then...
But you're saying that in general the buyer still owns the land.
Right, the buyer's going to...
And can you offer, in terms of the arguments we're offering, a reason why that's a seems like a sensible rule? Who's in a better position to detect the fraud?
The buyer.
The buyer of the land? That's the guy who originally bought the land, knew about the fraud, he was committing it. But the second buyer, the innocent buyer, how can he detect the fraud? He looked at the title that that the seller had, it was a perfectly good title. That is, the first seller is the one of the two innocent parties who's in a position to detect the fraud. He could have looked at those gold bars and said, those are awful light for gold bars, aren't they? Let's go get them assayed before I accept them. And therefore, along the lines we've been suggesting, it makes sense that in that case, it's the first seller who bears the loss, assuming we can't catch the guy who committed the fraud, because it's the first seller who, if he bears the loss, has an incentive to take precautions against that loss. How about a somewhat different case? This time, instead of buying the land from John with fake gold, I simply forge a deed to John's land. I then take the deed to Bill. John happens to be out of town at the moment, so he's not going to hear about it until I'm gone. And I say to Bill, you know, I bought this land from John. Nice land, you know it. Here's my deed. Let me sell it to you. And Bill buys the land. Now, when the fraud is discovered, who owns the land? The original owner owns the land. No way he can protect himself against somebody else forging a deed that he never saw. On the other hand, Bill could presumably have done things to check the legitimacy of that deed. So, and I think that those are, in fact, the common law rules, as I understand it. But it's a nice case where it seems as though we've got a plausible economic argument to justify the common law rules. In a certain sense, it's not an argument about justice at all, because it's the guy in the middle who's the real one who deserves to pay the cost. But he's not available. We've got a cost that's got to fall on somebody, and the argument is put it, allocate the cost in the way that gives the best incentives by putting the cost on the person who's in the best position to do something about preventing the thing from happening. Right. So let's do a quick review of insurance. Start out with the idea of risk aversion in money, which I tried to persuade you, whether successfully or not, isn't really a dislike of risk at all. It's a declining marginal utility of income, and that's one reason why you might want to have insurance. Because you're paying with dollars when your house hasn't burned down in order to get paid with dollars when it has. And when I say when, I don't really mean year by year. I mean in that one of several alternative futures, if that makes sense in terms of gambles. A reason not to have insurance is moral hazard, that when I insure my house, I'm creating an externality. I'm creating a situation where my incentive to take care of the house is less than it ought to be, because if I spend $1,000 on precautions against fire, I only get a fraction of the benefit. Most of the benefit goes to the insurance company. And that's a cost. The result of that is insurance will cost more than the average loss from the fire would have been if I wasn't insured. Because if I wasn't insured, I would have taken more precautions. But, as I point out, that's also an argument in favor of insurance in those cases where the insurance company is in better position to take the precautions than I am. And I ran through a number of examples where that seems to be plausible. And so the real bottom line of this argument, and this is sort of something that I think you usually don't get in discussions of these issues, is to put the incentive where it does the most good. That you really want to say, here is something bad we want to prevent. Which parties are in a position to prevent it? If you've got to put all the incentive on somebody, put it on the person who, given that incentive, is in the best position to prevent it. But quite often what you really want to do is co-insurance. You really want to say, we don't want the owner to do any really stupid things, so we'll have him bear part of the cost, but we want the insurance company to have an incentive to do at least the more obvious things to prevent the problem, so we'll give them some of the cost. And I'm going to suggest that this is an issue which really runs through a lot of the law. If you think about the accident law, tort law, from the standpoint of an economist, from the standpoint of a non-economist, the nice thing about the fact that when you mess up my car, I sue and collect money is that I get compensated. From an economist, that's the problem with it, because the fact that I'm compensated means I have less incentive to take precautions to avoid having you run into my car or hold down the cost if you do. So put the incentive where it does most good. And we then went on to talk about adverse selection, which is a problem with asymmetric information. Everybody understand what asymmetric information is? It's the case where, of the two parties of the transaction, one of them knows things the other doesn't, and typically the one who knows those things cannot believably convey them to the other one. And the problem with asymmetric information is that some transactions that would benefit both parties don't happen. And why don't they happen? Because my willingness to sell is a signal of low quality. You interpret it that way, you therefore offer a low price, and that means that people with high-quality products are even less willing to sell. Cream puffs don't sell. And the fewer cream puffs sell, the stronger the reason to offer a low price on the assumption that if your offer is accepted, it's probably a lemon. And as I suggested, this is a problem which, again, exists in a variety of places other than explicit insurance market. And I went through the particular case, which is, I think, beginning to become a political issue, maybe it's become already, of genetic testing. If there is no genetic test, then genetic risk, meaning the risk of having a gene that makes you likely to have a heart attack, is an insurable risk, because nobody knows whether you have or don't have that gene. And the residual risk, the uncertainty whether you have a heart attack, given what your genes are, is also insurable. On the other hand, in the world without genetic testing, you don't get to say, well, I've got this gene, so I'd better have a low cholesterol diet and take statins and do my 25 minutes of exercise three times a week and so forth. And the other guy doesn't get to say, well, I really like, you know, eating barbecued spare ribs, and by God, my genes are rock solid, and I can eat all that stuff I like, and maybe I'll get fat, but I'm not going to get a heart attack. Useful to have that information to know what precautions to take. Similarly, in planning your life, if you're thinking about a profession where it takes many years of training before you start getting a return, if you're likely to die young, that might not be a great idea. So it's useful information. Genetic testing clearly provides a benefit. Some people might think it provides a cost as well. There are some people say, well, I don't want to know if I'm going to die young, and that's sort of a potential problem, but you could, even with genetic testing, you could choose not to get tested. But it clearly has a benefit. But I'm arguing it has a cost, and the cost is to make certain risks uninsurable once you have the testing that were insurable before. If you have sort of what you might think of as the laissez-faire solution with testing, which is that, yes, the test exists, and the insurer can make any conditions he likes for insuring you. After all, it's a, you know, market transaction, happens if both parties approve. So the insurer says, look, you may say you haven't been tested, but I'm a suspicious guy, and I figure if you say you haven't been tested, it means you've been tested and you know you're a bad risk. So therefore, I'm going to say that I'm only willing to insure you if I get to see the results of your test. And once I've done that, if you've got good heart genes, I got a really good deal for you. Got bad heart genes, sorry, it's going to cost you more, but I'll still insure you. So in that case, the risk, the genetic risk, is not insurable anymore. The residual risk is still insurable for both parties, for the good genes and the bad genes. Next case is the one that I've heard advocated, which is that it's illegal for the insurer to make genetic tests a condition of insurance. And now the risk, if the effect is large, is that you'll have adverse selection, which means that insurance, in effect, won't be available for good risks. That the people with the good genes are being charged a price which reflects a worse-than-average mix of good genes and bad genes, because they reasonably believe the bad gene people are more likely to get insured. At that price, the good gene people are off. Many of them may well say, this is, I'd like to be insured, but not when I'm paying three times what on average I'm going to get back. Therefore, they don't get insured. That pushes the terms worse, and you could end up with what referred to as a separating equilibrium, where all of the bad gene people are insured, all the good gene people are not insured. That situation, at least, is worse than the one before, because it's still the case in that world that you can't get insured against genetic risk, because you're going to get charged on the assumption you have bad genes, and you can't get insured against residual risk if you have good genes. In a sense, the best of all possible worlds from this standpoint, but the one that may be unattainable, is the world where you can prove to the insurance company whether you've tested or not. Because then if you want to insure against genetic risk, you buy the insurance before you're tested. If you don't, you buy it afterwards. But that has obvious enforcement problems. Now, I should say, to be fair, if the effects aren't very large, then prohibiting the insurance company from discriminating might have only a small adverse selection effect, and it would have some equalization effect between bad risks and good risks, which you might think a good thing. But, of course, if the effects aren't large, then that equalization effect isn't very large either. So, all right. Before I go on to Chapter 7, any questions on any of the risk allocation, insurance, all that stuff? Questions? Yes? No? Maybe. All right. All happy, we hope. So ex post ex ante, this really comes out of a paper that somebody delivered 20 years ago or something that I heard, and just struck me as a very useful way of thinking about a bunch of legal issues. And so I spent the chapter sort of exploring how looking at that distinction, which is a fairly common distinction in other parts of economics, can help here. So that in a way, the easiest way of thinking about it, I would suppose, would be the employment context. If you think about you're hiring an employee, and you've got two options. You can pay him by the hour, or you can pay him by output. You can have a piece rate, they used to call it, for people who are building stuff, or you could have a commission system for salesmen. Whatever it is he's producing for you, you've got the option of either measuring what he produces for you and saying your payment is proportional to that, or just measuring how much input he puts into producing it and pay him by that. And you then think about what are the trade-offs between the two of those. And I'm going to argue that same issue shows up in the law all the time. So what's the problem with what's the advantage of paying by output?
Incentivize your employee to work harder.
Yeah, a different way of putting it is because you can't really measure input. That you can measure hours, but you can't tell whether when he's at home falling asleep, he's thinking out a better way of doing your job. You can't tell whether he's sitting at his desk, he's actually working out how to do his job, or, you know, planning his strategy for his date tonight. You may not even know whether when he's sitting at the desk, he's actually, the screen in front of him has actually got the spreadsheet he's working on or World of Warcraft. I've seen, I think it exists actually, some kind of a program which basically puts on your screen what's really in effect a screensaver that looks like a spreadsheet, which is designed to hit the button fast when you're boss comes around when you're actually doing, you know, viewing porn or playing World of Warcraft or doing something else your employer would disapprove of. And somewhere there was, where did I see, somewhere I think online, this cartoon sequence where the guy is doing World of Warcraft at his desk and the employer comes by and 2 minutes later he's apologizing to the rest of his group in World of Warcraft for the fact that he just had to drop them in the lurch and they all got killed because he couldn't keep playing. But in any case, the basic point is that you can't perfectly measure the relevant inputs, but, and this is the critical point, the employee can, or at least better measure them. So the employee, if he's rewarded by output, can say to himself, well, I'm falling asleep, I'm sort of bored, instead of thinking about the movie I saw yesterday or the television program, why don't I think about this idea that occurred to me for how to do my job better or how to sell cars better or whatever he's doing. And similarly, the employee who's sitting there at his desk can say, well, I could play World of Warcraft, but I'm not going to get much pay at the end of the month unless I produce some output, so maybe I better produce output as well. All right? But what's the disadvantage with paying by output? Is there a disadvantage? Is there always a disadvantage? Suppose what we were doing, suppose the output in question was yards of woven cloth. Go back up 200 years, you're sitting there at a loom weaving, and the employer doesn't want to have to pay attention to how many hours you're weaving. It'd be hard for him to know. In fact, maybe there is no employer. Maybe you're self-employed, in which case your payment is by output because you've got to sell the cloth at the end of the day, so to speak. But Is there any serious disadvantage to paying by output in that case?
Quality
of issue. Yeah, well, that'll get taken care of if you're actually selling it yourself. So it's true you have to measure the quality of output. But is there any disadvantage to paying by output as opposed to paying by input?
But
that's why I was taking the weaving case, precisely. In the sales case, what is the disadvantage?
They have no control over the worker has no control over the product, so if there's a product the market doesn't want, you're putting in a lot of hours but not getting anything back, so your workers...
That's one disadvantage. But the other disadvantage is that you also have no control over the economic slump, or over the fact that the competitor has brought out a new product, or over the chance, if you're thinking about the sort of thing where you make a couple of sales a month, but they're big ones, whether this month happens to be a lucky or unlucky month. The reason I was thinking about the weaving case is that's a nice predictable process.
Right.
So in that case, if you are sticking to your loom, as it were, you really will produce, you know, a yard a day or whatever the output is. But in the case of the salesman, even if you're working very hard, you might do very well, you might do very badly. So why is that a problem? Why is that? Is the fact that random events outside of your control might affect up or down your income a problem? After all, it might go up as well as going down.
There's less stability. There are so many people in this case that are salary and more competent people go with other people.
Why? Why would the more competent people prefer the fixed salary if the average payment is the same either way? Yeah, that's right. That is to say that payment by output, if output does have sizable random variables, gives you risk. And therefore, just as in the cases we were discussing before, there's a tension between the right incentive on the one hand and risk aversion on the other, between what you could think of as the equivalent of our risk aversion moral hazard before. And as I say, output isn't always observable, as in your quality case. It's another problem.
So how does that affect the weaver?
In the case of the weaver, if there isn't a quality issue, if it's easy to see whether this is cloth, then it looks like you unambiguously want to do piece rate. Right? Because if you're doing it piece rate, it's easy to measure the amount of cloth he produces. It's hard if he's weaving in his own cottage, how do you know how many hours he spends? Even if he's weaving in your factory, do you want to pay people to watch, you know, see how careful a job he's doing and so forth? So the argument would be, I think, that where there aren't significant random variables on output, and where output is easily measurable, and relevant input is not easily measurable, that you clearly want to reward by output. Where there are large random variables, but output is measurable, there's then a trade-off between the incentive and the risk aversion effect. In the extreme, the other case, where output is hard to measure, but input is easy to measure, now you have a strong argument for doing it by input. If you consider my case, it's not at all clear how the university is going to measure output, but it's also hard for them to measure input. Right? They know how many hours I'm in class, but they don't know how many hours I spend preparing those classes. They don't know whether when I'm falling asleep at night I'm thinking about what to say in class tomorrow, about the next novel I'm going to write, or, you know, my plans for dinner over the weekend or something. So that's a case where it's hard to do it either way. And you could try to do it, as you could imagine doing output by looking at student ratings for the professors, but it's hard to know if that's really the very relevant dimension, because, you know, that sort of everyone takes it for granted you can get a good rating by giving people good grades, but that doesn't mean you're doing a good job and it's not really improving the school as a whole. So that's a case where it isn't clear what the best rule is. Second point worth making while we're talking about this is that the definition of output and input isn't entirely unambiguous, because in some cases the output of one stage of the process is the input to the next. And that's my air pollution example here, where you could say that a Pigouvian tax is charging me for output, the output of air pollution, but someone else could say, no, it isn't, because I'm getting the same tax per unit of sulfur dioxide, whether or not the sulfur dioxide does any harm. That today, the wind is blowing out to sea, my sulfur dioxide hurts nobody, the fish don't even notice, and yet I pay the same fine as tomorrow when the wind is blowing into the land and everybody in San Jose has this stink in their nostrils. And ideally, that would suggest, if you could somehow measure not the amount of pollution, but the amount of harm done by the pollution, then I would have an incentive to try to, you know, work out when does the wind blow which way, and arrange my work schedule in such a way the pollution was mostly when the wind was blowing west. All right, so in that case, we really have sort of two layers of input-output, and the same kind of argument about what are the things that are more easily measured is gonna go in, and how large are the random variables we have. And similarly, if you think about a speeding ticket, I would usually think of a speeding ticket as an attempt to control an input, as saying driving fast. We don't mind driving fast, we mind auto accidents. Driving fast is an input to auto accidents. One way of controlling, how would you control auto accidents by output? How do we, in fact, control auto accidents by output?
That's torts, right?
Tort liability for damages. Could be other things. You could, you could imagine criminal laws, too. But in particular, we say, if you're in an accident, well, if you're in an accident, A, you've got to repair your car, and B, you may have to repair the other guy's car if it was your fault. So that's an output measure. But we also try to control them by saying that driving under the influence is illegal, even if you don't have an accident, and driving too fast is illegal. So in that case, we've got both what I think of as ex ante controls, controls on inputs, and ex post ways of making it costly to have the output. But even if you think about the speeding ticket, if I think of my own driving, the most dangerous things I do are unobservable. Because the most dangerous things I do are things like having a lively argument with the non-existent person in the other front seat about some subject I'm thinking about, rather than paying attention to my driving. Or having a lively argument with the idiot on the radio, rather than paying attention to driving. In general, thinking about something other than what I'm doing. Baroque trumpet music is sort of an example. I don't know how any of you feel about Baroque trumpet music, but it tends to be the sort of exciting, lively stuff, and you can get caught up on that, and, you know, you ought to drive faster when the Baroque trumpet music is getting your spirits whipped up and so forth, but you probably shouldn't drive faster because you're paying less attention. So there's a sense in which there are a bunch of unmeasurable inputs, which are in fact inputs to speeding and inputs to dangerous driving in general, as well as some measurable inputs, such as the speed itself. So in my analysis for most of this, and we may drop this at some point, I'm implicitly assuming first that it is easier to measure output than input from the outside. That it's easier to know whether or not I had an accident than to know whether or not I am behaving in a way likely to lead to accidents. All right, and that's going to be typically the case. It's easier to measure how many cars I sold than to measure how hard a job I was doing trying to sell cars from the outside. But I'm also assuming that it's easier for the actor himself to measure his input than for the observer, for the employer or the court system. So that although I can't do a perfect job, I can say to myself, oops, I'd better be thinking about the driving. The last 2 miles went by in a blur because I was thinking about something else, whereas there's no way the traffic cop can know that until I actually run into somebody. And I can also take, and do take, the really important precaution, which is that when my wife and I are both in the car, she's normally driving. Because she is much better at, the only exception to that is in very dangerous circumstances. That I am a good deal better than she is at dealing with problems in real time, at the kind of, although I should say World of Warcraft evidence is to the contrary, so it may partly depend on problems that can actually kill you as opposed to problems that are just on a computer screen. But she is much better than I am at paying attention to something boring for an hour. And therefore, when for long trips she drives, unless there's some particular condition that requires, you know, the ability and willingness not to freeze up if there's an emergency, but to do the right thing, and then I typically. But in any case, so my first assumption is that it's easier to measure the output from the outside than the input. The second is that if you're measuring input, that's easier to do by the actor than by the outsider. And finally, that we've got a probabilistic process. This is the difference between the weaving and the other cases, where the input only sometimes produces the output, so that you can drive fast for quite a long time and have no accidents. You can even drive drunk and get home safe and have no accidents. But on average, driving fast or driving drunk is going to result in more accidents. And from that, it follows that ex post gives you a better control over inputs because ex post gives the actor himself the incentive to try to do things that will prevent the bad outcome from happening. Is that argument clear enough? Sort of as a general argument why typically you would expect that you would like ex post for the kind of case where it's hard for the outsider to tell what you're doing, but you can tell what you're doing. However, ex post also, since we're talking about a probabilistic case, gives you higher punishments with lower frequency. All right, if every time I drive fast I get a ticket, that's, you know, a ticket once a month. If every time I drive fast and smash into somebody, I get locked up or fined or have to pay damages, that's a whopping big punishment every 3 years. Why do we care? Answer should be obvious by now. What's the disadvantage? Half the answer should be obvious. What's the disadvantage of the whopping big punishment every 3 years instead of the mild punishment every month?
Can't pay the big punishment.
You're ahead of me. You're right. But I was going to say risk aversion first. If you can pay it, you're going to have risk aversion. And the second problem is you can't pay it. I want to think about punishment costs. And this is something we're going to come back to because one of the issues in criminal, in using economics to analyze the criminal law is what are the costs of punishing people, since that's one of the things you have to do. If you think about a fine, I pay a $100,000 fine, supposing I've got the money, the court collects it. At first glance, there's a net cost of zero. I've lost $100,000, court's gained $100,000. But that really isn't true because of risk aversion. If I'm risk averse, then one chance in 1,000 of a $100,000 fine, which is what we're really talking about because we're imagining probabilistic kind of events, is actually more than a $100 cost to me. All right, I don't like, it's just like having my house burned down one time in 1,000. One time in 1,000 loss of a $100,000 house, I'm willing to pay more than $100 to prevent it. So let's suppose I pay $150 to avoid the risk of one chance in 1,000 of a $100,000 fine. In that case, on average each year, I'm paying $150 and the court's collecting $100. Every 1,000 years I get fined on average. So there is in fact a punishment cost even to a fine, which looks like a costless punishment, like a transfer. How about execution? Can you see why the punishment cost of that is typically much higher, not just because it's the bigger punishment, but higher relative to the punishment? What's the fundamental difference between a fine and execution?
Once your life is gone, it's gone.
Once my money is gone, it's gone too.
Nobody benefits from
it. Aha, that's it. The fact that when they take the fine, I lose the money and they get it. When they take my life, I lose a life and they don't get it. All right? When they execute me, the result is not that some dying person pops back up to life again, which would be the equivalent of the fine. So the execution, you have both the risk aversion cost, whatever it is, and the fact that it's an inefficient punishment. That it's a punishment where the amount received by the punisher is much less than the amount paid by the punishee, as it were. All right. So, in my hypothetical case, my punishment cost is the full amount punished, actually plus whatever my risk aversion is. If I have a risk aversion, I was actually assuming on the case there, I was assuming a risk neutral person being punished. He would still pay $2,000 to avoid a one chance in 1,000 of losing a $2 million life, supposing $2 million is his value of his life to himself. State gets nothing. Punishment costs $2,000. And you'll notice that the second case, the way I've set it up, and I probably should change that, I should make it a $200,000 fine instead. But the way I've set it up at the moment, the second case, the punishment is only twice as severe in the first case. But the punishment cost is 20 times as high. And it's important that you think in terms of the ratio of punishment cost to punishment, because in many cases you've got a choice between a 10% chance of this punishment, or a 20% chance of this punishment, or a 1% chance of this punishment. And if you're imposing a punishment that costs 10 times as much, but you're imposing it a tenth as often, total cost is the same. All right, is that argument clear? But if we're imposing a punishment that costs 50 times as much, a tenth as often, then average punishment cost is higher than with the alternative. Not sure if people are lost by my going too far on that or not.
Just raises a question in my mind, because we're talking about economics, but I've sat during sentencing hearings, and punishments are clearly not allocated along the basis of any economic factor.
What's an economic factor?
Well, what I mean is, like, I'm trying to think about how to explain it. We certainly don't allocate punishments in an efficient manner. No judge up there is sitting there thinking about really cost to society of the punishment. It's more they're looking at the individual context of the person. Does this particular person merit the punishment?
Well, I'm going to argue that at least much of the time that really is a proxy for economic considerations, because the economic considerations aren't only the cost of the punishment. Obviously, if the only thing that mattered was the cost of the punishment, we'd let everybody go free. That gives us a costless punishment. So you have to think about what are you getting for that cost and what you're causing, calling merit. Somebody might say, is this a case where if we punish people in this class of cases, that will result in bad things not happening? So if you think about the difference between the criminal who you say had deliberate intent to do something bad and the criminal who just lost his temper and, you know, picked up something and hit somebody, you might plausibly, I'm not sure it's right, but you could plausibly argue in the first case, punishment will the knowledge of punishment of that kind of crime will deter. In the second, it won't, so we're more willing to punish the first case.
Well, how about, I'm going to borrow an old trope and say, what about, like, punishment for marijuana use? Where you could argue that the cost to society, especially a libertarian argument, is the potentially the only person truly being damaged is the smoker.
And you know, he might be so badly damaged that he only won 8 gold medals at the Olympics. But all you're saying is that that's a law which doesn't seem to fit the efficient model. But of course, Posner's thesis is about the common law. That's statutory law. So that Posner certainly wouldn't argue, and I certainly wouldn't argue, that the actual legal system in all respects is efficient. And we're then talking, in figuring out what would be efficient, we're really talking some mix of, can you explain stuff? As a little earlier, I was explaining some common law rules about who bore risks as a result of fraud on efficiency grounds, along with what are you arguing it ought to be? So, no, I would agree that I think it would be very hard, at least, to argue that the war on drugs is economically efficient, and then you have to have some other explanation for it. But you can still think about the questions of punishment costs. And let's go on to imprisonment. And if you think about imprisonment, is imprisonment, in my sense, a more or less efficient punishment than execution? If we measure efficiency by the ratio of punishment cost to amount of punishment,
it's way less efficient.
It's less efficient than execution, because execution, at least, all we got to do is to pay for, you know, a hangman or something. Imprisonment, not only do we not get the liberty that the imprisoned prisoner loses, we got to keep the jail going as well. All right, that raises a puzzle which we're going to get back to in a month or two. Which is why we ever use imprisonment instead of just using lower probabilities of execution. Which sounds sort of bizarre, but is nonetheless, an interesting question. Now, there are other punishments you could think about, which we'll again get into later, some of which might be more efficient. But the point I want to make really is to show why punishment cost sometimes depends on the amount of punishment, and in particular, that the punishment cost is relatively low for fines, but most people have a limit to how large a fine they can pay. And that's a reason why typically you're going to get to more inefficient punishments as you go up, although as the execution versus imprisonment example shows, it doesn't have to be that way. You could imagine a case where the more severe punishment is actually more efficient. So high punishments tend to result in high punishment cost. Not only proportionally high, which wouldn't be a problem because the higher costs are paid less often, but more than proportionally high. And that's the argument I've just been making. Now, in addition to punishment cost, there's another cost associated with a lot of legal punishments, and that's litigation cost. That after all, it costs money to convict people, and it costs money to defend people, whether you're thinking about criminal or civil law. And therefore, you ought to think of one of the punishment costs as being the fact that you people have to spend your life making legal arguments in court when you could be out, you know, doing something useful like designing automobiles or programming computers or teaching kids or something. And of course, useful is a loaded way of putting it. But the point is only that the process of litigation is itself a cost, and we'd like to think if you believe, for example, that traffic tickets result in zero litigation costs because practically everybody receives a ticket and just sends in a check, which is, I suspect, true, whereas if you have severe punishment for being in an accident, that's likely to result in lots of litigation costs, whether it's criminal or civil. So these questions we'll come back to later. But what are the implications now for the ex post ex ante legal question? If the offense doesn't do very much damage, then an ex post punishment of about the amount of damage will not result in risk aversion, can be paid by a fine, and now we have pretty unambiguous arguments in favor of ex post. So, people see the issue, what I'm saying? Does it make sense or not? All right. Furthermore, tort law mostly uses fines, although we call them damage payments in that context. So therefore, we would expect tort law to, on the whole, be a relatively inexpensive punishment, though there's still risk aversion as a problem. And tort law, this is a point we'll come back to later, is pure ex post in the sense that if I do something that could have caused a tort and it didn't, even something where I tried to cause an intentional tort and it didn't, I am not guilty of the tort. That whereas intentional crimes are themselves, that is, attempted crimes are themselves criminal. So this argument then suggests that small offenses you want to use ex post. For large offenses, you probably want to use a mixture. You can use some ex post up to the fine people can pay, basically. But it's quite likely that ex post large enough to properly deter a really dangerous act would be much more than people could pay, and you then get into expensive punishments. So that would be an argument if you can monitor the input somewhat for using ex ante instead. Right. And that raises the interesting question of whether we have any pure ex ante cases. Right? The pure ex post case is the case where we only punish you when something bad happens. And the pure ex ante case would be the case where we try to punish you for inputs to something bad happening, but the fact that something bad happens is irrelevant. All right, does that make logical sense? Are there any examples? It's not true of the speeding ticket example, because the speeding ticket, you both get fined for speeding, and if the adverse outcome occurs and there's a crash, even if there's no legal action, you might get killed and you got to fix your car, but in fact, you may well be liable for damaging somebody else. Anybody think of any pure ex ante cases? Cases where doing the wrong thing that could produce a bad result, you get...
Possession of a gun.
What?
Possession of a gun.
Is it pure ex ante? What are you trying to prevent in that case? What's the outcome you're worried about? It's not bad people having guns is the problem.
Well,
why don't you want bad people to have guns?
And they might shoot someone.
And if they shoot someone, that will be a crime,
right,
and will be punishable. So isn't that really a case where you've got both ex ante and ex post? Or good people with guns, and you're afraid that they'll, you know, think the mailman is an intruder or something and shoot him. Or good people with guns, and you're afraid there'll be an accident. All of those, if the bad outcome occurs, there's at least a significant chance of costs to the person involved. The example a student offered in a previous year, which I think exists, would be pollution regulation, where you're immune from civil suit if you obey the regulation. So if you imagine that we've got the EPA telling me how much sulfur dioxide I can emit from my smokestack or whatever. If it's the case, as I think it often is, depending on detailed circumstances, that as long as I obey the regulation, the people downwind don't get to sue me in tort for the effect on them of the sulfur dioxide, that would be a case of a pure ex ante with no ex post. All right? I think that's a fair statement. But it occurred to me, thinking about it today, that there's a much bigger example, and that's negligence. That after all, if you have a part of tort law which is a straight negligence standard, then as long as I don't do the things that count as negligent, I don't owe damages even if the accident occurs. So that looks, it's not put in those terms, so we don't think of the negligence standard. And it's not quite the same because if I'm negligent, I still don't pay unless an accident occurs.
So it
doesn't quite fit, but it comes close to fitting in the sense that the punishment for being negligent is the damage done by the accident times the probability the accident will occur. Right? But the punishment of the accident occurring itself isn't.
Yeah. Well, like in, at least in California, the construction law,
yep,
they pay a fine based on the negligence that could or would have caused the accident, but the fact that the accident occurred doesn't increase the fine at all. And because there's...
I'm not sure I understand you. What is the construction law? What are you talking about?
You didn't put up proper barriers on the roof that you were constructing on. You'll get a fine from the OSHA, for $1,000 for not putting up the correct barrier. The fine does not increase or decrease if somebody falls off the roof.
That's very interesting. That's a good example.
And the employee fell off the roof for his errors have no ability to sue you because that's all otherwise regulated. You get a flat payout fee.
So they can't sue you even if you were in violation of the rules?
No, they cannot. It's all covered by workers' comp. So they get a flat workers' comp payout fee regardless
that's
of the fact that you were negligent by not putting up the barrier, which is what caused the person.
That's very interesting. Yeah, that's a good case. I didn't know that.
I was just going to say, you already said workers' comp generally. The idea that we've abrogated the common law tort system in most states, where you pay an insurance fund, you're essentially fined beforehand, everybody contributes, and then when you're injured, it's just a flat payment.
So then the input is working, basically, and that's you're being fined for, in a sense, in your contribution. Let me go on to a case which occurred to me when I started thinking about this stuff, partly because somebody had written an article on the subject which I thought got it wrong. And it's the puzzle, and I think it's the puzzle from two different directions, as it were, about how the law treats attempts. So let me start with my simple case. I was really mad at John, and I got out my rifle, and I aimed at John. I'm not a very good shot, and I pulled the trigger, and I hit the tree next to John. Well, John's fine, the tree's fine, what's the problem? Why should I go to jail? No bad outcomes. So it looks, sort of the economic approach, your first guess is we shouldn't punish attempts.
Well, but we don't want people to shoot at John, regardless of whether they're good or bad.
Well, we only want them not to hit John. We don't much care if they shoot at him and miss. I mean, it might make him nervous or something, but... wake up the baby, but...
Well, there could be someone sitting behind John, so...
Yeah, but I didn't hit anybody behind him either. I mean, then I'd be...
But we want the disincentive to you to shoot, because let's say you only have one intent chance.
But why isn't the fact that if I hit him, I'll get punished the adequate disincentive to shoot? Why don't we do it straight ex post? Anybody? Haven't we just answered this question on the general issue of how you deal with actions that have large costs? What's the usual way that we want to deal with actions that have large costs? Ex post or ex ante?
We want to deal with them ex ante.
We want to do both, typically. We want some ex post, at least up to the fine people can pay, maybe more in a case this extreme, and some ex ante. So that... you can think of it, of the punishment for attempts, as really a kind of ex ante punishment, where shooting at somebody is an input to hitting him. So what we're really doing is giving you 5 years for attempted murder and 20 years for murder, and what does that mean? It means that the ex ante punishment for trying to kill somebody is 5 years, and the ex post punishment for succeeding in killing somebody is 15 years. You get the ex ante punishment whether you hit him or not, and the ex post letting you hit him. So that's a way of thinking about that. Now, before I go on to the rest of what I have here, let me point out that there is a second puzzle in attempts in the opposite direction. Right? The economic puzzle is why punishment attempts at all. The puzzle, if you're thinking about law from sort of a moral perspective, is why do we punish attempts more lightly than successes? That after all, I tried to hit John. I'm just as guilty if I'd hit him. Being a bad shot is not a moral virtue. So why is it that I get off with so much lighter a punishment when I miss John than when I hit him? Well, one possible answer is that we believe we don't want to take a second shot. But after all, I wasn't discouraged from the first shot.
But so I take the first shot, and now there's 10 people watching me take the second shot. My odds of getting... I'm going to get the same punishment regardless of whether I get taught for the first shot or the second shot, so I have no disincentive.
So that's the marginal incentive problem. That's one possible answer. But again, that's an economic answer. And I was thinking, my point was that economically the puzzle was in the other direction, though I think we've answered it. That is, the answer to the economic puzzle is that the reason we punish the attempt is that a sufficiently high punishment for the success would either be undoable or at least more costly than we want. All right. So we therefore use a pretty high punishment for the success plus a lower punishment for the attempt. But the moral question, if you're thinking about it as a moral issue, now the fact that you want to deter him is irrelevant. Deterrence isn't a moral question. The question is, why don't we say he's just as bad a person when he misses as when he hits? And if we punish people because they're bad people, which it seems to me is sort of at the guts of a lot of the moral approach to understanding law, then why shouldn't we punish them equally severely in both cases? Yes, that's the question. Why shouldn't we say whether he hit the guy he shot at is pure random chance? That's not morally relevant. The relevant thing is he tried to kill somebody. Here is our punishment for being a bad person who tries to kill people. Why isn't that the right answer? So what? I can understand my economic argument, but I want to know, morally speaking, why do we care?
Well, he didn't really hit the person, so yep.
So he has what?
He's less guilty.
Well, even though the fact he didn't hit him had nothing to do with him? Puff of air made his bullet miss by a little or something? Let me suggest that in our moral intuitions, we actually have two parallel systems which give different answers, because I think it's true. And one of them is the accounting system. One of them is the system which says, I did a certain amount of damage, therefore I owe a certain compensation. And the other is the judgment system. I like to think of the accounting system as the kind of system that makes sense among equals. I don't know if you're a good person or a bad person, but I know that my car got smashed. Somebody's got to pay for it. Whereas the judgment system is really a sort of a God's eye view of the world, where we say, what have you revealed about yourself by your actions? And from that, what do you deserve to have happen? So the God's eye standpoint is a standpoint which says, look, this guy worked hard all his life. He was honest, decent guy, and by pure bad luck, he spent his life in an industry that collapsed just as he sort of got into it for other reasons. Somebody ought to help him. Something ought to be done about that. That's unjust. All right? Whereas that fellow over there, he was a lazy slob. But it just happened that what he enjoyed doing with his time was playing Dungeons and Dragons. And the Dungeons and Dragons was this magnificent growth industry. And so he got a job with Hasbro now, I think. It doesn't Hasbro. No, it's not Dungeons and Dragons. Hasbro owns Magic. Right. With Wizards of the Coast. Is it Wizards of the Coast?
I don't remember.
Which it is. But he got a job with whatever firm it is. And in spite of being a lazy bum who spent all his time having fun, he's now making $100,000 a year, and it'll be $200,000 next year. That's wrong. All right. So that's one set of intuitions, it seems to me, is looking down at the world and saying, what do people deserve? In fact, you can think about it as one set of intuitions is about desert and the other is about entitlement. That if, simplest case, and this is a case that the philosopher knows it gives you, you and I bet a dollar on a flip of a coin. I win. I'm entitled to have you pay me a dollar, but I don't deserve to have you pay me a dollar. I don't deserve to because I didn't deserve to have the coin come up heads. All right? How the coin fell was a morally irrelevant act, and yet it has morally relevant consequences because the deal we made was that heads you pay me a dollar and tails I pay you a dollar. Is that a way of thinking of it? Anyway, I
mean,
yep.
There's plenty of evidence for it. I mean, the idea that we punish a pound of marijuana possession differently than 10 pounds of being a dealer.
That is all. I think if you look at people's actual responses, they depend on both.
I guess what I meant is that, no, they're both, but they both kind of have to be there, then, because if you say that owning the difference between...
They don't have to both. You could certainly imagine a legal system that was pure entitlement. You can imagine a legal system where we say, if you shoot at the guy and miss, no harm done, go home free, but if you hit him, you've done a certain amount of damage, you've got
to
compensate for it.
What I meant to say by they both have to be there is not that they have to be there in an absolute sense, but in this situation, the observable results that we see in our legal system certainly...
Look as though they reflect both.
Right, and I think what I was saying is, even like the drug possession laws, yep. Having 1 pound of coke versus 10 pounds of coke, you could say that in one sense they're both equally bad, or as bad, but the difference between owning 1 and 10, we make a judgment.
Yep.
That
I'm not sure that we would. It seems to me people who support the war on drugs presumably would say it's bad because it harms other people, and the 10 pounds is going to harm 10 times as many people as one. So you might say, you know, you're only a mildly wicked person if you're willing to harm 50 people for your own money, but you're a really wicked person if you're willing to harm 500. But the point I'm making, going back to this attempts business, is only that if you're thinking about it morally, you have the puzzle, essentially, of why the outcome should matter at all, as opposed to the input, as it were, which is what we're judging you by. And this is, in fact, a fancier version of this is what philosophers call the problem of moral luck. So let me give you a more extreme version of the same puzzle, just as something I think interesting to think about. Suppose you knew that somebody had been a concentration camp guard in Nazi Germany. You would probably think badly of him. Suppose you read a study which showed that the random German at the time, if offered the job of being a concentration camp guard, would have had a more than even chance of accepting it. Do you now feel almost as badly about any German at all who was alive during Hitler, who was an adult during Hitler's rule? And I think the answer is you don't. Maybe you should, but you don't, even though the fact that one of them was and one of them only might have been is pure moral luck. It is. Similarly, another example in our intuitions, if you know that somebody drove a little bit drunk and ran down a small child, you'll feel a whole lot worse about him than if you know that he drove a little drunk, almost ran down a small child, but the child jumped just in time. So that even though what seems as though it's morally relevant, namely what he did, is the same, somehow at some gut level we judge people by what happened, by the accounting approach, at least as well as. As it happens, the very best discussion I've seen of this, but I think I've got other things I want to say before I go back to it, so I may not, is in a book written more than 200 years ago. It's Adam Smith's less famous book. Adam Smith wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which is what first made his reputation before The Wealth of Nations. And he has 2 chapters discussing the puzzle of why we judge people by the morally irrelevant question of what happened rather than by the morally relevant question of what was happening inside their heads, so to speak, what they intended. It's quite a neat discussion, but I've probably digressed too long for the moment. All right. So you can think of the punishment for attempts as an odd sort of ex ante punishment, where shooting at someone is an input to hitting him. Next question, which I've really answered already, but I'll go through the PowerPoint slide, is instead of punishing the input, why don't we just punish the output more heavily? Why don't we just say, all right, you shoot and miss, we're not going to worry about it. You shoot and hit, we're going to boil you in oil, or the equivalent. And one answer is punishment costs, that as usual, we're combining an ex ante and an ex post. If we believe we can't get adequate deterrence with a pure ex post, at least at a cost we're willing to pay. Let's go to a next question, which is not quite the same, but it's sort of related to that. Why do you punish impossible attempts? So let's consider the question of whether attempted murder via voodoo ought to be illegal. All right. Suppose we find out that you had that you're somebody from Haiti. You believe in voodoo. You really hated him because the girl you wanted ran off with him instead. And so you went to a appropriate practitioner, bought a voodoo doll of him, and stuck pins in it. And oddly enough, he's fine. But you've been caught. Should you be punished for attempted murder, which is what you engaged in? What do you think? What's the economic argument now? The moral argument is perfectly clear. It is, morally speaking, it was attempted murder, all right? But the economic argument, should you, the argument against punishing you is say, look, we don't care if you stick pins in a voodoo doll. It doesn't kill anybody. It doesn't hurt anybody. Is there any argument for why we should punish impossible attempts, attempts to kill people by methods that won't work? Likelihood of harm. It's a much more difficult concept than it may seem. Because after all, I could say that when I shot at him and hit the tree next to him, that was an impossible attempt too. No way I could kill him by hitting the tree.
Well, we didn't kill by shooting at him.
Well, I thought I could kill him by shooting at him, but turns out I was wrong.
But there's like people who might kill him by shooting him.
But part of the problem is that when you say a likelihood, you're really juggling between an idea of an objective probability and a subjective probability of likelihood in terms of what you knew versus likelihood in the real world. If we knew enough about the real world, we would know that there was no chance at all I would hit him. After all, at the point when I pulled the trigger, my gun was aimed over there, not over there. It's only because we're thinking of it from a perspective where we don't know precisely where the gun was pointed that we think of it as a case where there's a certain probability of hitting him. All right. Well, but then from the standpoint of the person who kills by voodoo, that person believed there was a probability of the method working. Should we or shouldn't we punish voodoo murder?
We're imposing a penalty in cases where there's less certainty.
Well, let's put it differently. We're imposing, one way of putting it, is the question really should we punish, is the question, is the way the people we want to deter see the issue? Do you punish voodoo murder or do you punish impossible murder? Because if it's do you punish voodoo murder, then we aren't deterring voodoo murder, we don't care. If it's do not punish impossible murder, then since they don't know whether or not what they're doing is an impossible method, the fact that we don't punish impossible murder means that if it turns out that what they're doing won't work, they'll get away free. So suppose that instead of voodoo, it's poison. And the reason it's impossible is that the poison that you tried to kill him with was in fact blue food coloring that a fraud had sold you in the claim that it was a deadly poison. That's no more dangerous than sticking pins in a voodoo doll. And yet, if we imagine that when you buy the poison, knowing it's on an illegal market, you say to yourself, there's some chance that this is just blue food coloring, but if I'm lucky, it's cyanide, then the knowledge that if it's really blue food coloring, you'll get off free makes you more willing to poison him, and maybe it is cyanide and you'll kill him. Is that too complicated a way of thinking about it? That trying to kill someone in a way that might not work does make death more likely. And if the legal rule is, if it turns out the method you used couldn't work, then we let you off free, then we're reducing the ex ante punishment for attempted murder. All right. So really, if you think about it, the impossible case sort of blurs into the attempted case. There's a certain sense in which if only we knew enough, all unsuccessful attempts were impossible. Right? No way I can kill him by shooting right there. And that blurs into the extreme case where everybody except the murderer knows that it's impossible because we know that voodoo doesn't work. Let's think about the relevance of all of this to insurance, because it turns out that insurance can be looked at as a way of turning ex post punishments into ex ante punishments. All right? In a way, that's what you do when you insure your factory against fire, but then the insurance company says, here are the rules of what you have to do. They're making you do certain things ex ante in exchange for their taking the risk ex post. So suppose we had a pure ex post system in which what happens when there's an auto accident, and I'm going to forget about how we decide which party is liable, but that when there's an auto accident, I pay the full cost of fixing both cars plus anybody in it who got hurt. I don't like that. I don't want to have my entire life savings at risk in case of an auto accident. So I go to an insurance company. I say to the insurance company, I'll pay you money and you agree that if I have an auto accident, you'll pay all those costs. And the insurance company says, well, we're willing to think about that deal, but we're a little worried that if it's costless to you to have an accident, you may not drive very carefully. So therefore, in addition to your agreeing to pay us money, you're going to agree to obey some rules, just like putting in a sprinkler system in your factory. Only now, one of the rules that you're agreeing to is a speed limit. That you're agreeing that, I'm assuming now, remember, this is a world which was pure ex post, so there were no speed limits. No punishments for drunk driving. The punishments are all for being in an accident. Pure ex post system. When you buy insurance, you're eliminating the ex post. But the insurance company says, wait a minute, if there's no punishment ex post or ex ante, you're going to drive very dangerously, and we're going to make our insurance very, very expensive, because otherwise we're going to go bankrupt. So the insurance company says, we're going to make ex ante rules, and you're agreeing to those ex ante rules in exchange for the insurance. And those rules are sort of like the ex ante rules we would have had in a world which we had ex ante. Speed limits, rules against drunk driving, and so forth. And we've now converted a pure ex post to a pure ex ante. Or, if the optimum arrangement is a mix of ex post and ex ante, the insurance company co-insures, they'll take 90% of the loss, but you take the other 10%, and they impose these rules. All right? If you think about that case, the interesting thing about that is that we now have a mechanism in which private self-interest is going to lead to the optimal mix of ex post and ex ante. Because I, the individual who is deciding what insurance policy to buy, the insurance company is covering its costs whatever I do. They'll charge me a higher price if I don't accept the ex ante rules. And so I am saying, what are the costs to me of these ex ante constraints? What are the advantages to me of the risk spreading through not having a big ex post punishment, of avoiding the ex post punishment costs and so forth? And I'm making that trade-off in my own self-interest. So we now have a private mechanism for generating what is, in some sense, the optimal mix of ex post and ex ante. Okay. Now, of course, in that system, the insurance companies then need their own traffic cops because they've got to be able to enforce those ex ante rules. But they can subcontract that job to the California Highway Patrol and make a deal which says that when the Highway Patrol sees you driving at 90 miles an hour, they do a quick scan of your license plate and the computer system comes up and says this person is contracted with State Farm not to drive more than 70 miles an hour. In addition to whatever else you're doing, please forward the information so they can fine him $500 for breaking his contract. So it's a somewhat science fictional framework, but I find those frameworks sometimes useful for trying to think through the logic of the system to imagine how it would work if the actual choice, instead of being made by a legislature in deciding what the rules were or by a court system in deciding on damages, if the choice were actually made by individual parties deciding on their own person. So, to summarize the idea, the question we're starting with is, do you control an input or an output? The advantage to controlling an output is that it's easier to measure the actual damage than the expected damage, and that the actor usually has better information than the outside people, and therefore the actor can monitor his inputs more accurately and more cheaply than the outside people can, and use his private information. One point I haven't mentioned, though I think I mentioned in the chapter, is that I've been assuming that the actor's private information of what he's doing is reliable. And one counter-argument you could make, which is beginning to undercut the usual economic assumption of rationality, is to say what, I don't know if it's true, but I'm told it's true, that if you poll people, a large majority of people believe they are above average drivers. So, on the one hand, if you really are a great driver, if you're a race car driver, It would be perfectly rational for you to make a different choice about speed limits versus other things than for the average driver. But if you just think that you could be a race car driver if only they let you, then the result of your making the decision based on ex post might be worse than their making it based on ex ante, because they might know the real facts about the relation between input and output. All right, so really, I've been assuming what seems to me plausible but not inevitably the case, that the actor, the driver in my case, knows the relationship between what he does and what happens at least better than the court system does. You could imagine cases the other way around where the court system knows it better than they do. Right? Advantage to regulating the input is that it lets you use smaller punishments more often, which is often more efficient, and that the relevant efficiency question is punishment cost relative to amount of punishment, because you're having trade-offs between big punishments rarely and small punishments often. And you can also see that one consequence of regulating the input is that you can impose the court's beliefs about causal relations. For example, after you've drunk two beers, you're not safe even if you think you are, rather than the actor's beliefs about causal relations. And sometimes the court's beliefs might be better, and sometimes the actor's might be better. In practice, in many contexts, we do both. We have both ex post and ex ante. And also, because the output of one act is the input of another, the same law might be viewed as both. So, we have about 3 minutes. Questions, comments, anything else you want on this subject before we go on to our next subject next week? Everybody's happy? Wants to go downstairs and buy a brownie? My experimental evidence, but it's probably age dependent, is that one brownie is enough to get you to marginal utility.